Maybe we'll get started. The clock is ticking. So my name is Scott Lisinski. Thanks for everyone for coming today. The meeting here is going to be on the record. It's an on-the-record meeting, just to clarify that. If you have cell phones, Blackberries, all that, etc. We have two rows in the back, which are Blackberry text messaging rows. So, I'm just kidding. A short commercial. Usually, it's about past USIP efforts on the issue of the day. I'll mention some future efforts as well as some past work. Look out for a future publication by Alistair Harris on Gaza reconstruction, lessons learned from the early lessons learned from the Lebanon experience post 2006. Also, Fred Hoff, who some of you know, has prepared a study for the Institute, which we'll release soon, on Syria, Israel, on the Golan question, on the boundary and what things might look like in a situation of a peace treaty between Israel and Syria. People know Fred Hoff. They often refer to the Hoff line. Anybody know what the Hoff line is? Anybody? The Hoff line. You need to find out. Very important what the Hoff line is. L-I-N-E. Also, we've done a lot of work, ongoing work. You want more volume? There you go. Moni Yacoubian has a six-part series of publications on Syria, all kinds of subjects related to Syria. We have a whole host of other things. The Institute is somewhat hyperactive on these issues. Most of our work is free, not all of it, and most of the events are open, so I encourage you to come back. Let me quickly introduce the speakers. We're very lucky to have this group of three. I'll go in reverse order from how they will speak. Tom Dine, who's here today, who has been working intensively on a dialogue project with Syrians and Americans through the search for common ground. Tom Dine also was, I hope I get it right, president or executive director of Radio Free Europe. Also executive director of APAC. He knows the Middle East for a very long time, and Tom has had the opportunity to travel extensively in Syria in recent years. Yoram Perry, who is... we love Yoram at USIP because he came here on fellowship and he did his project, and it's now an acclaimed book, his second book, I believe, on civil-military relations in Israel. The book is called Generals in the Cabinet Room. I was in Israel last week. Yoram and I went into a bookstore on Dizengoff Street. They have mostly Hebrew books, not English, but your book in English from the Institute was right there on the shelf. Yoram is teaching
this
year. Good for the Institute, good for Yoram. It's a terrific book. Yoram is also engaged as a private citizen in Israel in advocacy for Syrian-Israeli peace talks. He can talk a little bit more about that. He's teaching here this year at American University in Washington. Henri Barkey is probably the longest-running, non-salaried figure at the Institute of Peace dealing with Middle East issues, published many reports here. A book, I think, has been working with me and a number of others on our Iraq and its neighbors effort. We've traveled together in Turkey. Henri has done a lot to help promote the Institute's work in trying to engage Iraqis and their neighbors. We're deeply indebted to Henri for all that he does for the Institute. That's in reverse order of speaking. What we're going to do is have a conversation, try to keep it interesting for everyone. I have a round of questions for the three speakers, and then, like they say in the game shows, we'll have a lightning second round before we have one comment from our community here, and then we'll open it up for questions. So let's just not waste any time. Henri, we'll start with the role of Turkey. What role has Turkey been playing in these, some call them pre-negotiations, some call them proximity talks, some call them peace talks? What role has Turkey been playing? Why has it played that role? And some have argued that maybe we've reached the limit of the Turkish sponsorship. Have we? Is there more for Turkey to do? Please.
Well, I have prepared lots of remarks, but now that you tell me that you're not going to pay me, I'm not sure I will... well, we're starting kind of with the Turkish role, which of course is in some ways the least important because the negotiations are between the Israelis and the Syrians. But what I would say is that in order to understand why Turkey did what it did and where it can go with it, we have to put it a little bit in context. And the context is we need to evaluate the, this government in Turkey, the Justice and Development Party, or AKP as the Turks call it, that party's conception of foreign policy. And here, this government came to power thinking that Turkey, and I think rightly so, that Turkey was punching well below its weight in international affairs, had no real presence internationally. And they very quickly and very assiduously started to work on improving Turkey's image in the world, and also in getting Turkey involved in many different things. And this is, people usually look at it as Turkey being interested in having a regional role, but I would argue that it is more than a regional role. It's a global role that they have in mind. And maybe, and we can talk about this in the second or third round, they may have now be punching way above their weight, but that's another issue. But as a result, you see Turkish diplomatic activity everywhere. It's not just the Israel-Syria track, but you know, when the Georgia crisis started last year, Erdogan was off on his plane going to Moscow, to Georgia, and so on and so forth. He has volunteered to be an intermediary between the United States and Iran. He has also gotten involved in Lebanon. And on a global stage, you can look at Turkey's, after many, many years, for the first time, the Turks are now in the Security Council. They had not been on the Security Council since 1960, and this government deserves a lot of credit for getting there, because it took a lot of planning and effort to get there. Okay. But the Israel-Syria negotiations is what the Turks get the most credit for. And when you look at those negotiations, Scott asked me if we reached a limit. I would argue that there was always a limit that they were going to reach anyway. But the only, yes, the Turks got involved, but you also have to understand that the Turks got involved because the Bush administration had created a vacuum in the region, and the Turks just took advantage of it and stepped into it. If you had a very active American administration in the region working on these issues, I don't think the Turks would have been able to take part in it. Now, why did the Turks get involved? You know, in some respects, it's not just that the Turks wanted to get involved, but it is also the Syrians. And I think Bashar Assad, President Assad, did very smartly engage the Turks for a whole variety of reasons. It was part of his strategy to break through the isolation, the post-Hariri assassination isolation. It was partially to have another relationship, especially one that had been under his father, a particularly bad one. But in many ways, I think for President Assad, the issue was to consolidate the relationship with a new government in Turkey, which he thought was different than the predecessors. And he did it very smartly. And I think that the relationship between Erdogan and Assad is particularly good. And on top of that, both Assad and his wife have become extremely popular in Turkey. They now spend their vacations in Turkey. So it's become, PR-wise, and if you think about how many journalists and go to Syria, the Turkish journalists, and what they write, I mean, it's been a radical shift from the point where Syria used to be the place that people associated in Turkey with, where the PKK leader, the Kurdish rebel movement's leader, lived for many, many years. So the Syrians, by essentially bringing in the Turks, were essentially also obviously playing into the Turkish ambition to become an important player in the region. So in a way, I would think that Bashar Assad played the Turks exceedingly well. The Israelis, and Yoram can talk more about this, obviously, the Israelis also understood that there was no point in saying no to the Turks who wanted to be involved. I mean, there's no harm that can be gotten by the Turks doing something at a time when everything else seemed to have stalled in the region. At least this also provided the semblance of forward movement. And what did the Turks do? I mean, the Turks brought the two sides together. I think they had four or five meetings. Two diplomats. One, a very close confidant of the president and the prime minister, the kind of the eminence grise of Turkish foreign policy, guy by the name of Ahmet Davutoğlu, and the deputy undersecretary for Middle East, a former ambassador to Israel, Feridun Sinanoğlu, who probably is today the best diplomat the Turks have. Those two run the negotiations by themselves. I mean, very little staff. They didn't bring too many people in. And the whole point was, I mean, to get the parties as close as possible and at the same time kind of break the ice. I mean, as one of them told me, you know, the first time they met, you know, they were all in three different hotels. I think by the third time, the Turks moved into with the Syrians, so there were two hotels, and they shuffled in between. And the third time, I forget the sequence now, but they moved in with the Israelis. And the idea was, in the meeting, the final meeting that was going to take place recently was, or the future meeting, was that the all three would be in the same hotel. Maybe it's cheaper to have them in the same hotel. But look, in the final analysis, everybody knew that it is the United States that would close the deal. That without the United States, nothing would happen. I mean, the Syrians want the United States in, and obviously the Israelis want the United States in. And the Turks also understood that in the final issues, because if the guarantees are involved, the Turks cannot do anything. But they get enormous amount of credit, one. And two, let's say 6 months from now, you have Israeli-Syrian negotiations, they and the participants in these talks also told me, the Turks think that they deserve a seat at the table. So that you would have United States, Turkey, Syria, and Israel. The Turks are doing, the Turks are doing this because they want to be a global player. And of course, the region is the easiest place to show their influence. But I would say, when it comes to being the fourth chair at future negotiations, if they ever happen, I think that's now in doubt after Gaza. And I'll stop here. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Henri. You mentioned the vacuum created by the Bush administration not engaging or walking away. You know, there's also a vacuum, one might say, regionally. Just listening to you, I'm thinking you surveyed the key players in the region, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran. Only Turkey has the confidence of both the Syria and Israel. You know, Davos aside for a minute. But
and this is why I think that Davos becomes a problem. The Turks understood very early on was that even if they didn't particularly like the Israelis, that in order to have influence in the region, they had to have good relations with both sides. And they had. The question then becomes, what happens now after Davos? And we can talk about this later. But the point is, yes, there was a vacuum that they filled. Yeah.
Yoram, tell us where, from the Israeli perspective, sometimes perspective matters in Arab-Israeli negotiations. From the Israeli perspective, what's the state of play now? Where did these pre-negotiations start? Where did they stop? Within the Israeli political system, which is hard enough to understand, even when there's not an election going on in Israel, but within the Israeli political system, can you also give us some insight into what are the forces, not just the political parties, but movements and even people outside of government, like yourself and your allies and your work, who's pushing for the Syria track or the Syria or engagement with Syria?
Well, I think that for every student of international relations, the case of the negotiations between Israel and Syria vis-à-vis the Turks is a fascinating case study, because you have a very strange situation. The most bizarre one is that you have a prime minister who is trying to conclude a deal 2 weeks before the elections, knowing that not only that he is not popular in the country, he's not popular in his own cabinet and within his own party, and still tries to reach an agreement, sort of agreement, or at least some declaration, joint declaration, that will help him to have his legacy when he leaves power after several months. So that's a very odd, almost bizarre situation. Interesting to analyze. And the fact that he was really doing it almost on his own, without the support of his cabinet or the Knesset or the public opinion in Israel, there's room to discuss that. But let me start with something else, and that is to look at the manifestos, the platform. I prefer to use the British system, though it's an old-fashioned term, platform. In the past, it was very important for parties before elections to discuss the platform. And I will never forget in the late 50s where one of the small but important leftist party had three meetings conference to discuss whether on the platform they should describe themselves as Leninist Marxist or as it should be Leninist hyphen Marxist. Today, no one discusses the platforms anymore. It's personalities, and the platform is done just for students to look in the future. But I have looked at the platform of all the parties in Israel, and I found really a very interesting picture. On the left, or on the right, the extreme right, the party that is going to be this story, probably this story of the elections, the Israel Beiteinu, our Israel, or our home Israel, led by Avigdor Lieberman, the Russian-speaking super hawk, he says, Syria, peace for peace, which means no territorial withdrawal at all. The Likud party, and Netanyahu probably is going to be the prime minister, Syria is not mentioned in the platform at all. Syria doesn't exist, or the negotiations of Syria do not exist. The Labour party and Kadima do mention the negotiations with Syria, and they have a very similar approach, which is a centrist one. In the Labour Party, they say that there is a willingness for a territorial compromise in return for a fundamental change in the regional policy and for in return for security arrangements and normalization. And Kadima says that Syria should express its willingness and readiness to make peace before the territorial negotiation starts. And then you have small parties on the left, or only one party on the left, that speaks about the need to make peace with Syria in return for territorial compromise without any conditions. So generally speaking, the mood in Israel, or I'll say something else, generally speaking, in the last several years, the public opinion in Israel moved to the right. And therefore, we are going to see a majority to the right-wing bloc in Israel in the elections. Whether it will be, whether Netanyahu will be the prime minister or not, that's a secondary question, but the right-wing bloc will definitely have 65 or so seats, while the left-wing bloc will have 55 seats. And for practical purposes, even less than that, because the Israeli Arab parties are not considered kosher for being members in the coalition, and therefore the ability to create a left-wing coalition is very small. My own forecast is that Netanyahu will be the winner, but he will try to create a coalition of left and right, and he will try to bring into the coalition the Labour Party as well, so he will not be at the far end of the left of his coalition, but he will be in the middle. It's important that we'll talk about that later, because I do think that with Netanyahu we can continue to talk about his perception about the negotiation with Syria, but I will leave that later on. What I want to say is something else at the beginning, what was discussed in the last year or so. When our organization has been created about a year ago, the purpose was to have it's called Israel-Syria Peace Society. We did it about a year ago because we thought that we should start with people-to-people approach, as we didn't see any readiness by the government to negotiate with the Syrians. When it became publicly known, the government said no need for that, and no one is going to negotiate with Syria anyhow. And then we realized that Olmert do want to have negotiations with Syria, and pursue them in a very advanced way. And we were very happy about it, so much so that we are not trying to do so much public advocacy for second track, but more for changing the positions of the Israelis, because the vast majority of the Israelis today do not want to have peace with Syria if it includes withdrawal from the Golan Heights, about 70 to 80%,
used to be much less than that. And before Syria declares publicly, openly, directly to the entire world that they are going to end their special relations with Iran and stop the support for Hamas and Hezbollah. So the problem is as follows, and this we have two planes here. One is the term of the agreement. On that issue, Israel and Syria are very close. Don't forget that in the year 2000, people who knew the contract said that 80% of the problems were solved. Here, I don't think there is much to discuss. But what is to discuss, and this is what was discussed by the Israeli and the Syrian interlocutor through the support or the help of Turkey, is the general preconditions. It's the discussion about the discussion. It's the negotiation about the negotiation. There was the problem. And why the Syrians want to involve the United States, or they say that the next stage will be meaningful only if the United States will be part of it. The Israelis said all the time, the next stage will be meaningful only if you will declare these preconditions, namely that you will withdraw from your strong alliance with Iran and your support to the terrorist organizations. And I believe that there was some advancement in these issues. I think that on the second one, I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe that Olmert understood that he cannot expect the Syrians to declare, to come out with these declarations before negotiations start. But hopefully this will be the result, the end of the negotiations. While the Syrians were very firm about their position not to further negotiations into another higher level before there's a change of policy in the United States, and that is where we stand here. And so I think that the next stage will be really to see what will be the reaction from Washington. This will lead the next stage of negotiations between Israel and Syria.
If I can do a quick follow-up, two things you alluded to that seem to be impediments on the Israeli side. One, this, and it seems to be a debate, according to what you say, over Syria's posture regionally and what a peace agreement with Israel would mean for Syria's other relationships, some of which Israel isn't fond of. There's also the question of confidence-building measures or symbolic diplomacy, which is an old issue in the Syrian-Israeli negotiations and Israeli interest in seeing some and the Syrian disinterest, at least in the way Israel defines those kind of steps. If you focus on the numbers, you put forward numbers that seem quite impossible to overcome, 70 to 80% opposition to a deal with Syria. What would bring the numbers down the most? A clear understanding and a satisfying response on that, on Syria's posture regionally, or is the symbolic diplomacy, you know, is it everything?
It's both, but don't underestimate the symbolic gestures. The same figures were of Israelis apply to the issue whether we should sign peace treaty with Egypt. We have peace with Egypt for 40 years almost. And there was a very high level of disbelief that we will ever reach peace with Egypt. And President Sadat came to Jerusalem and spoke to the Knesset and overnight changed the dramatic majority against peace to a fantastic majority for peace. Just one visit to Israel. It is true that the chief of staff thought that that's a plot. Egypt is preparing another attack on Israel. And he went out of the country a few days before that and leaked to one of the newspapermen that this is the position of the military, which was a huge scandal. But it was not a plot, and Assad came to Israel, and Sadat came to Israel, and the public opinion in Israel changed its position. Our small movement are begging everyone that we see, tell the Syrians, do some gestures. It's childish. But most people are childish, not as your president told you in his inauguration speech. If a smile, shaking hands, not to talk about more serious things, might change dramatically the position of the public opinion. But we are told that's not the style of the Syrian people to do that. On the other element is much more important. And here, there were some Israelis who for a long time believe that Syria is willing to make peace with Israel. One of them, for example, is two of them, important people. One of them is Shaul Mufaz, who was the chief of staff and is now number two in Kadima. And the other one is Bogi Yaalon, the former chief of staff, who is now the top military person in the Likud party. Both of them advocated negotiations with Syria and agreed on the proposal that was put on the table in the summer of 2000. They said, we are fine with that. Let's make peace. They have changed their mind in the last 2 years. And they think that they think that without a clear demonstration that Syria is changing its strategic and geostrategic approach, we should not negotiate with them. So it's both the public diplomacy for the people, for the public opinion, and some deep understanding for the negotiators.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tom Dine. You have for 2 years now, maybe more than 2 years, been meeting intensively with Syrians, talking about U.S.-Syrian relations, but also talking about this question. Meeting, I'm told, sometimes for days on end. So you have a tremendous wealth of experience. Mm-hmm. What, in your view, what first and foremost, what's motivating Syria to renew peace talks now? How, as the question, I'll just ascribe it to others, as the question is often put in Washington, how serious are they? And last, what do they expect from the United States?
Thank you, Scott. First of all, I'm going to correct your use of 2 years. It was only I've only been involved for 11 months.
11 months.
And it seems like
an eternity, right?
No, it's been a very short but very stimulating period in my life. But it was only 11 months ago that my friend and the founder and president of Search for Common Ground, John Marks, who's sitting in the front row, called me and said, hey, I want you to go to Syria. So he's given me a new chapter in my life in doing so. And so somebody asked me, as we were waiting around and before this session began and drinking coffee, why do you do this? And I do it because I believe strongly, and I'm deeply committed to advancing American interests in the world. And secondly, the idea of a Syrian-Israeli peace document will be a landmark for the Middle East and for both countries. So I think both the United States and Israel's interests would be served, and I think Syria, which is really in a time warp, would also be served by this. So I don't speak for Syria. I'm an American citizen concerned about American positions in the world, and so I want to clear the decks right away about that. Syria plays a pivotal role in the Middle East, and particularly in this time of change. So it's absolutely essential that we engage it. So immediately, I want to put myself right on the front line. I'm not a disengager. I'm not an isolator. I believe in engagement. No matter what, because it can only get better, although sometimes it does get worse. But so the first answer I have for your question about what motivates Syria is I believe Syria was very pained by its isolation, its diplomatic isolation, economic isolation by the U.S., by the EU, and for many, many years, as earlier Henri indicated, by Turkey, by Israel. With the renewal of the peace talks with Israel under Turkish auspices, by the way, in my experience, both the Israelis and the Syrians are highly appreciative of the Turks. They stand tall in that region today. Despite the recent commentaries having to do with Gaza. So Syria began breaking through its isolation in these talks in these various hotels. The Doha agreement of last spring, alongside of a new French government led by a dashing president, Sarkozy, broke Syria free. So it's very important to understand that feeling that the Syrians had and the desire to get away and get out of the bonds of isolation. So Syria is back on the map, and they feel very good about that. There's no doubt about the mood in Damascus, and I've been there several times in this particular period. Secondly, it's very simple. Syria wants the Golan Heights back. I can't tell you how many times in my visits somebody has said to me, grabbed my arm and said, "That's the Golan Heights. That's Mount Hermon," which you can see from on a clear day from Damascus. And at night you see the Israeli contingent on top of Mount Hermon, and they always tease me saying that the Israelis are watching you. Well, we'll see. Third, Syria wants a normal relationship with the United States, and I think this is as much of a reason as honor about receiving the Golan back. And so we all have read this, written this, commented on this over the years, that the road to Washington leads through Jerusalem, but in this case, that's the way they see it. And they're definitely going through Jerusalem in order to get here. Fourth, Syria wants to deepen its engagement with Iraq. And Iraq is a sticking point in the U.S. relationship to be with Syria. But Syria is serious about Iraq, and as one comment I've heard, we Syria do not want a Lebanon on our eastern border. So they believe in somehow or another a strong central government in Baghdad, a friendly Iraq, and Iraq in which they can participate in reconstruction. Sixth, Syria's leadership knows that its future as a regime in power depends on it being a secular society, which is under attack now, as the Islamicists, whether they're out of northern Lebanon within their own society, stimulated by the Wahhabis, they're very concerned about keeping the place secular, and they feel that with foreign policy successes, they can make the case internally to keep the militants at bay. Finally, my seventh reason is by opening itself up in foreign affairs, by somehow or another achieving a normal relationship with the United States, that the Hariri Tribunal can be deflected. Now, it becomes operational on March 1st. What's going to happen after that, nobody knows. Probably not even the prosecutor. But this is an anxiety-creating issue for the Syrians, and they're trying to do things now in foreign policy, foreign affairs, that will offset what that tribunal could or could not do. But obviously, and they know that the international community holds Syria accountable for its past actions in Lebanon. So, yes, the Syrians are serious. Yes, they're looking at a bigger picture than just the region. And I'd like to see, this is just me now hoping, that in the calendar year 2009, we're going to see a lot of changes in U.S.-Syrian relations, Syrian-Israeli relations, and U.S. relations with the whole region.
Thank you. Tom, maybe I'll start. We'll go reverse order on this very quick second round. You offered the perfect segue. So, yes, they are serious. What are the kinds of what are the early choices and decisions that you think, and I'll ask the same question to the other two, that are faced by the Obama administration as they just get going and approach not just this issue but the sort of larger Middle East? What are the choices? What are the early decisions? And if someone from the administration was in this room and you were telling them they're serious, and then the next conversation would be, well, how do we test it? You know, what kind of test could you come up with?
And if I may add, Tom, what would the answer to your question about the Israeli points preconditions that the Israelis put so strongly before them.
If anyone wasn't sure, Yoram proved he is the Israeli on the panel. We thank you, Yoram. Tom, and then we'll go to Yoram and
Ari. As I heard your question, Scott, it's immediate stuff, and then Yoram's intermediate point. So I'm going to pick up, Yoram, on your point. Gestures. Building trust. The first thing is that the rhetoric has to stop, the negative rhetoric, and particularly the phrase that you hear all the time in Damascus, are you still trying to overthrow our regime? Quote, unquote, regime change. So change the rhetoric, end comments about the regime change, and actually Bashar has made the first move. He sent a letter of congratulations to newly inaugurated, sworn-in Obama. And I think it came 2 days after the ceremony. To the best of my knowledge, there has been no letter in return. So the Syrians are worried. And in their way of thinking, as I understand it, they've become suspicious that their letter was not answered.
Now, the fact that Mitchell didn't visit, does that add to the suspicion?
Not yet. Right. Not yet. They, at least the ones I interact with, understand that Israel-Palestine is something to focus on, and he had previously focused on it when in 2000, 2001. Not yet, anyway. So the in terms of positive gestures, I certainly would like to see a return to the way it was before we did a little attack across the Iraqi-Syrian border, and afterwards the Syrians closed our cultural center, closed our school, and really shut tight Ahmed East. So opening those three entities would be a good gesture, opening round gesture, if you will. Then you've got two embassies. And both of them are sort of treated as, this is a slight exaggeration, as pariahs. The Americans in Damascus, who's without an ambassador, don't have full range of going throughout the government and throughout the society. And the same with the Syrian embassy here. So this tension with the normal diplomats that are assigned in a normal bilateral relationship need to switch from negative to positive. Also, U.S. has to acknowledge Syria's role when it has been positive. The treatment of the Iraqi refugees, for instance. Ambassador Jim Foley in the State Department, who does refugees, has testified on Capitol Hill and has acknowledged some of the things that Syria has done, but it's muted, nobody knows about it, very few people know about it, and that needs to be amplified, if you will. Negotiations with Israel. The fact that the Bush administration closed the door to any kind of, we're going to be involved, the Syrians took as an insult, and therefore, and obviously the first 3 weeks of the Obama administration, there's a whole different mood, there's a whole different atmosphere, but it hasn't focused yet on Syria, but hopefully it's coming. The Americans will want to see political, military cooperation with inside Iraq and on the border, and in turn the Syrians want involvement in reconstruction. So that's another early move that can be made. Now to explain to the Syrians that yes, you want an American ambassador to return, but that person, whoever he/she is, has to be nominated. Now that the person has to reveal his or her taxes, and to get through the advise and consent process. And that's going to take time. So I don't think there will be an ambassador in Damascus before June 30th, but we'll see. But that's an early move that the Americans can make. And I believe there is consensus on Capitol Hill for sending an ambassador back. Now it's a question of who, and the strategy has to be written and whatever. The Americans are going to have to put into a policy paper what to do about sanctions and the Syrian Accountability Act. Do we ease interpretations? Does the administration ask Congress to change the law? There are ways of handling this, and I don't think it's been looked at closely, but this is, again, now I'm getting into the intermediate stuff. There's the Syrian application to WTO, and the whole need by Syria to change its economy. It's still in the 1950s in many, many ways. It desperately needs commerce and opening up its agricultural sector. The oil and gas is easy, but it's really a bigger economy. And, you know, the good news for the Syrians is they haven't been affected by the international meltdown economically, but the bad news is that shows they're not part of the global economy. And so the Americans are going to have a very intermediate and long-term policy there. And then finally, working with, and I'm very serious about this because it just hasn't happened, working with the Turks, the Israelis, the Syrians on restarting the peace treaty and get to that fifth round, that sixth round, and we're back actually, there's been recidivism. In 2000, there was a trilateral negotiation, Syria, Israel, United States, and it's only been the two countries with Turkish intervention. But now it's time to get really serious and come back to either a triangular or even a quartet, as you indicated earlier, Henri. So that's my immediate agenda, and slightly getting into the...
Well, it's a very rich and diverse menu. Doing only half of the things you laid out would probably be a real game changer for these dynamics. Yoram, what do you think, what are the early choices and decisions for the Obama administration? In particular, you know, a week from now we'll know the results of the Israeli election, and in a few weeks we'll have a new Israeli government. What kinds of conversations should Washington be having with Israel about Syria and about the prospects for peace?
I don't think that I present personally the position of the majority of the Israelis on that issue. I believe that the protracted conflict in the Middle East can be solved only with deep involvement of the United States. The Israeli-Egyptian conflict could not have been resolved without being changed from a zero-sum game to a non-zero-sum game. And you change the game only if you add another player into the game. And I don't think that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will change if you don't have a very major player that will change the entire nature of the game. With Syria, I don't think that we need a third partner, but they demand it, and therefore we need it. So it's not the nature of the conflict, it's their national interest. And I agree with you that they have to pay with peace to Jerusalem to get pave their way to Washington. So if that's the case, the United States has to be more involved. And the question is what sort of more involvement? If I can summarize, it's impossible to summarize the position of one Israeli, but if I have to summarize the position of the Israelis, they are a little cautious about the position that the new administration will take. They are a little worried that that over-activism will not work for Israel. But as I said, I think that it should be done. It should be done for the Palestinians, and it should be done for the sake of the Syrians. But here I will probably develop what I began to say earlier. It seems that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is really stuck and will continue to be there for some time. I cannot see a change, neither in Israel and nor in Palestine, concerning the negotiations. But there is a hope vis-à-vis Syria.
And that is not so much because Barak, who was against negotiations with Syria 2 years ago, when we started our organization, he wasn't for it, and he changed his position. He's for it very much, and he supports it very much. I believe that Tzipi Livni is not against negotiations with Syria, but she thinks that the Palestinian-Israeli track has to have to be first in line. There might be a very interesting development with Netanyahu. Now, this is my pure analysis. I might be totally wrong. I was a journalist for some years, so I'm entitled to be wrong. Unlike my academic background, Netanyahu might find the Syrian track easy for him, and he will imitate and follow the way that Begin did. Begin was not willing to negotiate with the Palestinians, to recognize the Palestinians, the PLO, and to give back territories on the West Bank. And he found a way to change his position by negotiating with Egypt and pay with giving back Sinai. For him to give back Sinai to Egypt wasn't such a difficult thing to do, and he got both peace and a Nobel Peace Prize. For Netanyahu, the West Bank is more complicated because it's from an ideological point of view to give away that part of the land, and from political reasons, because his coalition will be much more extreme today than it was 10 years ago. So he will not be able probably to pursue seriously negotiations with Palestinians. But knowing that the status quo does not help anybody in the area, he might think to himself probably that it's worth negotiating with Syria. He already did it in the past. It's an open question how much he was willing to compromise on the Golan Heights. He says that when he sent his envoy Ron Lauder, he told him that he's willing to negotiate from part of the Golan Heights. Some people say, who know the facts, who say that he hinted that he's willing to withdraw from the entire Golan Heights. It's not 100% clear, but the fact that he is willing to negotiate with Syria is there, and if some of the basic premises will be explained, understood, agreed, then he might find that a wonderful solution for himself and his cabinet to be involved in 2 years of negotiations, to reach an agreement, to get Nobel Prize, and to postpone the Palestinian issue for the next generation, which is what he wants to do. So maybe that this. There is a silver line at the victory of Netanyahu, if he will be indeed the prime minister, that maybe negotiations with Syria will be resumed even under him.
Thank you, Yoram. I came back from Israel earlier this week, and the one thing that's unmistakable in Israel, where they have very loud, raucous elections, is that everyone is doing their best, center, right, left, to project a warmth towards Washington. Whether it's President Obama or Senator Mitchell, who was there a few days ago, it's unmistakable. Everybody's sort of on their best behavior and trying to project because we all know tension with Washington is terribly damaging to any Israeli leader. And there's a lot of issues in the Israeli election, but relations with Washington and signals and symbols about who can deliver the best relations with Washington is definitely a big part, and I hope that's also watched here, because there's a lot of influence and leverage that comes to us because of this dynamic within Israeli political life. Henri, last to you on Obama, early choices and decisions.
Look, it appears that as this administration looks at the region, one decision it has to make, or it appears it one decision is: does it go for the Israel-Palestine track or the Israel-Syrian track? And even if the Israeli-Syrian track may appear to be the low-hanging fruit, I suspect that the administration will probably choose and give its emphasis to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, because that, in the end, is a core issue, and in the end, it's the most explosive one, and that's the one where there is the greatest amount of damage, as we saw in Gaza, that can be done to both sides. So my guess is that that's what the administration will choose. But I don't know. I mean, journalists are sometimes wrong. Academics are always wrong. And so That's, but it is also true that Obama has a very, very unique opportunity. A, because he's coming after George Bush, that's one. But more importantly, I mean, his personality, his standing in the world, and his promises so far is also, in my mind, can create an opportunity. He can create an opportunity in the region where he will inject enormous amount of dynamism and push the process forward. But for that, he has to be involved. It can't be Mitchell. It can't be Hillary Clinton. It can't be all envoys of all kinds. He will have to do it. When I say he will have to do it, I don't necessarily mean that he should sit like Bill Clinton and go over maps of Jerusalem and decide what street should be whose. But in reality, what he should do is do something very, very symbolic and start, maybe do a trip to the region. This morning I went to a talk at OSI, and I forget the name of the person who suggested it, but I heard the best idea so far in many respects. You know, Obama has promised he's going to do a speech to the Muslim world, and my hunch was always that he was going to go to Indonesia, because Indonesia is the place where he's been, he's going to get a lot of support, etc. And somebody suggested, a human rights person from Egypt suggested that maybe he should go to Ramallah. Maybe he should do the speech from Ramallah. And I think, now, that's part of what I would argue is, it's not just Ramallah, it's Jerusalem and Ramallah. It's Israel and the Palestinian Authority. You give two speeches, one on each side, and push the process forward and say, I am committed, I want this process to move along, and I want this process to move along quickly. I mean, enough dilly-dallying, we've been working on this for a very long time. But it is a kind of symbolic dynamics. But as I said, I mean, he also will have to continue to be engaged and push the process. But there is this little other thing called the economic crisis. And as you can see, it hasn't been smooth sailing so far. And I think the problems are pulling him in that direction. We don't know how quickly he'll be able to be clear of some of these things. But it's a high-risk venture, because you don't go in and the first act as your president in foreign policy, go in into the most intractable part of the world and put your whole presidency at stake there. But, you know, Bush was a gambler on the other side. Maybe Obama is a different type of gambler. And I hope he does it, and more power to him.
Thank you, Henri. Your first comments about the two tracks and the trade-off often that's seen, not just from Jerusalem, but a trade-off here in Washington. You know, there are some of us who hope that maybe the U.S. can walk and chew gum at the same time, and that maybe the trade-off isn't necessarily one or the other. But certainly we'll see. Before we open it up to a general discussion...
When I meant the big Obama step forward, Jerusalem, Ramallah, that would give an impetus to the whole region. It's not just... and that Syria would be included in that.
And we have it on record here. Henri did not propose that Obama give the speech in Turkey, which is what I thought you were about to say. We're joined by a partner and a friend, Murhav Shojati, who offered to give a few quick initial reactions. And then we'll open it up if people have questions for the panelists. There's microphones on the side. Murhav, please.
Do I do that without a mic?
You don't need a mic. I'll repeat if people don't hear.
Well, I never would have thought that I would see the day where a chairman of AIPAC would be representing Syria. This is absolutely great.
Former.
It is great, and Mr. Dine, I identify with most of the things that you said with regard to your trip in Syria, but I do have a few remarks. Syria is in this not because of its isolation or to break out of its isolation. It was in a decade-long peace process with Israel before its recent isolation. And if we look truly at Syria's contemporary history, Syria, for the most part, had been outside of the realm. I once interviewed former foreign minister and vice president Abdel-Halim Khaddam. I asked him, why is Syria so difficult? And he said this was a
moment of self-criticism, I guess. He said Syria is the only one that likes to hold the ladder sideways and go through the door anyway. Syria needs peace with Israel as a result of its acute awareness that Israel is superior militarily to any combination of Arab power. And if Syria is going to get back its Golan Heights, it's not going to be through war, but it's going to be through peace. It knew this before Iraq, and it knew this before the assassination of Hariri. Again, this is why it had engaged in a decades-long process with Israel. I admire your efforts and those of Mr. Perry to bring about peace between Syria and Israel. This is truly a noble thing to do. But I ask Mr. Perry, we constantly are asked what gestures Syria will make. My question is, when is it that Israel is going to make any gestures? How can Syria make gestures after the Israeli former Prime Minister Barak screwed up a historic opportunity to reach peace with Syria in the year 2000? According to President Clinton, he got cold feet. I think recently we witnessed a second historic opportunity missed. We were going to go to direct talks with the Israelis through the mediation of Turkey, but there is that little thing called Gaza. And whenever, Mr. Perry, you and others who are as noble as you in the Israeli spectrum, who want to reach peace with the Syrians and engage in second-track diplomacy, and you excite the Syrians very much in that second-track diplomacy, then there is some massacre or some catastrophe that happens that screws up yet again the process. My question to you is, what gestures Israel needs to make in order to allay Syrian fears? It's no longer a question of, is Syria willing to make peace? I think it is on record that it is. The question is Israel willing to return the Golan Heights? You mentioned Mr. Barak, one of the contenders for power in Israel. He has already failed to do so in the past. Ms. Livni is more into the Palestinian-Israeli approach. And I am of the view that Mr. Netanyahu lives on Mars. What approach to Syria? When there was the negotiations through Lauder, he gave President Assad a small map with a very large marker delineating the border. It was an insult to human intelligence. And I was told when Sharon, before his illness, before his coma, that Sharon may be the answer. You are telling me now that Netanyahu is the answer. I don't think so. Professor Barkey, I have to tell you, Turkey, I think, earned the place at the table, and it did an absolutely magnificent job. The Syrians did not turn to Turkey after the assassination of Hariri. In fact, I interviewed President Assad himself after his landmark trip to Turkey in 2004, and he was absolutely elated with what he saw in Turkey. And so that love affair with Turkey for Syria started way before the Hariri assassination. I do not agree with you that the Obama administration will choose Israel-Palestine first. Certainly there must be a consolidation of the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. That certainly should be first. But I think in order to crack the nut of the Middle East, you have to have a Syria-Israel first. Otherwise, Syria is again would again be put in the position to be a spoiler and not a stabilizer. Thank you.
Thank you, Morhaf. If I can even just tag on quickly to Yoram, or even to Tom. Tom knows Israeli politics well. Is it Morhaf's question was what gestures can or should the Israelis make, but I'll take it a step further. Do Israelis and do the Israeli political elite believe that they even have to make gestures? Or do they see, maybe rightly or wrongly, I would say wrongly, do they see politics in Syria as non-existent, and therefore it's not incumbent upon them to even have to think and plan and conceive of gestures?
Well, your answer is partially correct, but I'm very disappointed with the question that was raised. I represent my opinion, which is not mainstream in Israel, but now you are forcing me to answer to give you the answers of the majority of the Israelis, which I hope to prevent in this conversation today. Israel should give gestures to Syria?
Syria, who supported Hezbollah for 8 years militarily, when after Israel withdrew from Lebanon with the support of the UN and the international community, continued to be attacked day by day by day with serious weapons? Israel should present itself that is willing to make peace, or Syria? But I really don't want to go into this debate, because I can give you a list of 15 strong arguments which I try to influence my people that forget about that. Let's open a new stage, and you force me to go to that. I'm sorry about that. But I will be attacked by most of my friends by saying that Syria means peace. It wants to make peace. And at least there is an equilibrium between the accusations of both sides. I didn't start with accusing the Syrian position for its support of the continuation of the conflict in the Middle East. And we can go back to the 50s, or to the 60s, to the 70s. I'm not talking about mistakes which were done like Chief of Staff Rabin in 1967 when he spoke about hitting the regime. Israel has, of course, I mentioned that during the negotiations in 2000, it was the Israeli position that withdrew in the last minute because the Prime Minister thought that he will not have a majority of the public opinion. But please, let's not go into accusations, because if you do that... But I would suggest something else. I don't think that there is a good book, and maybe that could be a project of the USIP, to look at the Israeli and Syrian counter-perception of reality. I don't know which chapter will be heavier, the Israeli or the Syrians.
You and Warhoff will write
it. It will be a beautiful book.
Tom, Dine, or Omri Barkey, do you want to comment at all before we do some more questions?
Well, I've learned that in any kind of... When you bring adversaries together, it's... You have to be very sensitive and delicate on bringing up the past. And one of the foremost, I would say she's world-class mediators, is sitting in this audience, Susan Collin Marx. And I've learned from her that there are ways of looking ahead and being cognizant of what's taken place. So I feel Yoram's emotion, if you will. But having said that, the Israelis can always do gestures, and we could list them already. It's been very rare in the Syrian way of thinking that when you go, or the two metaphors are always being used. The cards you hold, I always hear that one, or in the souk we do, and we bargain. But I think the way to really to handle this is, first of all, answer the question that both sides ask when we go back and forth. The Israelis always ask me, are the Syrians serious? It was asked here. The Syrians always ask, are the Israelis serious? And the answer is yes. Both sides are serious. They don't want a peace process. They want a peace document. And that's the proof in the pudding. And to get that document, you're going to have to compromise. And therefore, the Syrians, and they haven't really focused on this, I don't think. Yes, you're going to get the Golan back. It's going to be demilitarized. There will be a water agreement. There will be a delineated border, unlike 2000. And there will be normalization of diplomatic and hopefully economic relations. But what are you going to do about Hamas and Hezbollah? And when you bring the Americans in the room, they're going to demand it, I assure you. Not because they're Israel's lawyer, to quote Aaron Miller about President Clinton, but they're going to do it because it's an American interest to be the bad host and get Hamas out of Damascus and to stop fueling the arms to Hezbollah. And that's when the Syrians are going to think twice about gestures and whatever.
I will introduce Ambassador David Mack, who wants to ask a question, but I'll ask the others as you come up, if you could, in addition to asking your question, introduce yourself and also try to ask a question. We take statements here, but usually in the form of a question. Please, Ambassador Mack.
David Mack from the Middle East Institute. And my question is for you, Yoram, because I know that you are the expert on the relationship between the Israeli military and the Israeli political class. And in your assessment, your analysis, you gave us a great descriptions of the various Israeli political parties and their positions. You described Israeli public opinion. I'd like to hear what you have to say about the views of the top IDF and other Israeli national security professionals.
If we could, Yoram, let me give you an opportunity to think about that for a minute. And in the interest of time, if we could take, I'll take the second question now. Then you can reflect, Yoram, give it some thought, you know. Here, please. Yeah.
Thank you. Hussein Abdul Hussein with Chatham House. Mr. Dine, why do you think the Syrian regime is so interested in deflecting the Hariri tribunal? Does this mean they're involved in one way or another in the Hariri assassination? And do you think that America should help Syria deflect this tribunal on Lebanon? Thank you.
Who wants to go first?
The cool one. The cool one.
Don, we're going to have your bump. We're going to produce a bumper sticker after this conference about Dine's rule on looking forward, or Susan and right. Susan and Dine's rule on looking forward.
The Americans want to find out the truth. Nobody knows what the truth is, and certainly I don't. There are a lot of people with evidence, and there are a lot of people with suspicions, and. Something horrible happened in 05. And therefore, the UN, in its wisdom, has created this commission, which is supported internationally, and therefore it's going to take its course, and we'll see where it goes. It's the old story. When we look at ourselves here, and mistakes have been made, it takes a course, and you never know where it's going to end. Watergate, whatever. So I don't have any judgments yet. We'll see where it goes. And now I can't remember your second question, but I think I.
Well, can I throw in? Do you think, from your conversations with Syrians, do they expect or believe the U.S. can kind of turn this on or off like a light switch?
No.
Or do they have a different view?
No. I think they quite recognize that the Americans have a big voice, but this is a UN deal, and we. Not only myself, but others, have tried to emphasize that Lebanon is a bigger concern to Americans because of the American involvement in Lebanon over the last 150 years or more, and also there are Lebanese-American citizens, and therefore what takes place in Lebanon is of the utmost interest to the United States and its people. There's a lack of a, I dare use the word, lobby, for Syria. And so Syria looms large, particularly in Democratic Party thinking.
Yoram, I'll give you a chance to respond.
That's an easy question, and it's a fascinating question, because unlike what probably most people think, the Israeli military, as of 1988, supported the option of signing peace agreement with Syria. The entire line of chiefs of staffs, heads of military intelligence, head of strategic body within the military were for it until the last one, until 2 years ago. And even now, the position of the Israeli military is for an agreement with Syria. And until now, they were even ready to withdraw from the entire Golan Heights. I myself spoke several times with Bogi Yaalon, Moshe Yaalon, when he was chief of staff, and he told me personally that he begged Sharon to sign an agreement with Syria. And Sharon said, A, I cannot negotiate both Syria and Gaza, withdraw from Gaza, and B, which was probably A for him, or at least for the public opinion, Washington won't let me doing that. So the military was very much for an agreement, and therefore I'm optimistic about the option that Netanyahu will take it over, because if he has the support of the military, it will be easier for him to persuade the public opinion, because you don't have on the Golan Heights these emotional sentiments, religious background, the settler movement, etc. But in the last 2 years, the strategic issue became more important. And that was not as important as it was in the year 2000, both relations with Iran and with the terrorist organizations. And don't forget, after all, that suddenly something which probably was a nuclear installation was found in Syria who wants peace with Israel. So no wonder that the military intelligence and other military officers will be today more cautious at the basic strategic posture of Syria. And therefore, they are more cautious today, more than they were 2 or 3 years ago. But generally speaking, I believe that if these issues can be solved, and Israel will have these guarantees that Syria does want to change its military and political posture in the Middle East, the military will continue to support that position.
We'll take two questions here, and then we have two on the other side. Please.
Jeff Steinberg, EIR. I'd like the appraisal of the impact of the Israeli-Gaza operation, to what extent this has really fundamentally changed the character of the regional situation, noting Prime Minister Erdogan's comments recently at Davos, feeling betrayed that there were meetings 48 hours before the attack began, and how much more difficult does it make it from the Syrian side to continue ahead, given the still ongoing questions around what happened in Gaza.
Thanks. We'll do one more question. I'll do the introduction here. Radwan Ziadeh, who is a former senior fellow here at the Institute of Peace.
Yeah, thank Radwan. You, Scott. Three questions. The second, one for Tom. It's you mentioned that the secular society in Syria under threat. And just to remind us that in 1952, the Syrian prime minister at that time, his name Faris al-Khoury, and he is a Protestant. And the majority of the Christians in Syria are Orthodox. That means he is minority of the minorities. And he became prime minister with support of Muslim Brotherhood at that time. When you have democratic system, when you have authoritarian regime like what we have now, unfortunately, you expected that we have more Islamic groups rising and the extremists. The second question that I believe that U.S. should engage Syria, not because the negotiation with Israel, but because it's better for two societies. Let's go back that in the education way that Syria, the only country that 72% from the professors who are graduate from the former Soviet Union is Syria. And this is maybe more than Russia now. It's you can imagine the impact that if you have exchange programs between the U.S. universities and the U.S. And the Syrian universities. I think the relationship between Syria and the U.S. will be benefit the two societies. It's important. And the third point that you said, Yoram, that Syria should cut the relationship and say that publicly and loudly with the relationship with Iran. I think that Syria will not accept.
Nobody said that.
No, you're wrong.
Not in these words, but let go on.
But Syria will not accept, of course, that as preconditions. But maybe they make different approach to the relationship with Iran, even that the Iranian regime has the upper hand on Syria, different than what's during Hafez Assad era. I believe that if the negotiation is started, we can put all the cards on the table. But before that, nobody will accept, because the Syrian perspective will see, should Israel withdraw from the occupation, Golan Heights, which is a very legitimate demand. But I think that during the negotiation, you can put all the cards on the table, but not before. Thank you.
Excellent questions, if I can just comment. Also, Radwan, who was a participant in a discussion here about a year ago on human rights in Syria, his argument, which was phrased in a question on engagement, in light of the human rights dimension, is, I think, an argument that's not as well understood here and a very important one. While I'll give you each an opportunity to react if you want, and then we'll have two final questions, and then everyone will be free to ponder what we've talked about today and decide what you can do to move this forward. Any of you want to start first?
Just shortly, the issue of the
relations between Syria and Iran. It is true that publicly and officially the position of most Israeli leaders was a year ago when everybody knew that negotiations began to take place, that this is what we expect Syria to do. Now, I don't judge politicians a month or 2 months or 3 months before the elections. Of course, before the elections, that's what they have to do. The question is, what is their perception about the deep willingness of the Syrian regime? And I guess that any prime minister or defense minister in Israel, unless Lieberman will be the prime minister, will want to be sure what is the real position of Syria. How it is expressed publicly, it's a secondary question. And if the real meaning, if the real essence of the Syrian strategic move is towards the West and towards the United States, that's fine. In this case, you can be very happy with the phrase that was written in the agreement in the year 2000. There it says, the parties will establish and develop friendly and good neighborly relations, will refrain from the threat or use of force, directly or indirectly, against each other. If I know exactly the position, the real position of the president, this is fine sentence with me. If I'm not sure about him, about his position, I will have to write in the document and that he will declare that he will do this and that and that. So it depends. So it's a matter of trust. That's the major issue. Therefore, I said that in the year 2000, 80% of the document was written, and the agreement is already there. The basic question is the question of trust. Most Israelis are suspicious of the real interests of the Syrians, and most Syrians, I'm talking about the political class, most Syrians are suspicious of the real interests of the Israelis. Once we get over this one, the details, where the line will be, or how much water Syria will get, or how many days Syrian fishermen will be able to go to the Kinneret, there's no fish there at all. So this issue will be solved.
Tom, do you want to say anything?
Yes, on the question of the impact of the Gaza conflict on Syria, with my colleagues, we were there during week two of the Gaza conflict. It cast a heavy, heavy pall over Damascus for sure, because every shopkeeper had their television on and mainly looking at Al Jazeera. Any time that you saw children being wounded, maimed, dislocated, traumatized, whatever, that of course affects everybody, including ourselves. So it affected the mood. But we found that as long as we recognized each other's sadness and in each other's concerns for human life, the Damascenes went on with their business, with ourselves, with others. I think, and I've seen over the past 11 months, I've seen every time there's a conflict or every time there's something to do with the Palestinian children, it affects the Syrians. When it's about Palestinian rights, Palestinian will they achieve a state? They're distant. It's not. It doesn't bring out any passion. I'm sure that's not true for everybody, but I'm just giving you one observation. So time and distance, I think, play in the Syrian mind, and that's why I remain optimistic. I believe a Syrian Israeli peace treaty can be negotiated and finished in calendar year 2009. About Syrian society, well, look, it's minorities obviously have a very strong role there. 12% of Alawites rule the country. That's not a very big margin, but many others have lived there and continue to live there. And I think certainly the Western-oriented Syrians that I've become acquainted with, they like the idea of a multi-religious, multi-ethnic society, and that's what they want to see flourish in the future.
Tom, maybe if I can hold for a minute there. Henri wants to get a quick comment, and then we'll do the last questions.
On Davos, Gaza, and Muhaf, your point about the Turks having earned a seat at the table, this is not up to me to decide whether they have earned a seat at the table. I was questioning the fact whether or not they've jeopardized it. And then let me put it to you why. It isn't Davos that did it. It is the fact that Prime Minister Erdogan basically said that he was going to Turkey was going to represent the Hamas viewpoint at the United Nations Security Council. And that, I think, has undermined Israeli confidence in Turkey. I think the damage there is actually quite considerable. I mean, he has also made all kinds of statements that are, you know, borderline anti-Semitic, if not fully anti-Semitic. But so there is definitely a crisis of confidence. And the Israelis are quite pragmatic, and I think they will play it depending on how it suits them at the point in time. But don't expect that the Israelis now will trust the Turks anymore. Right? They may talk to them, but they won't trust them. It will take, Erdogan has to do, I mean, first of all, the diatribe in Turkey has to end, and it hasn't ended. In fact, Erdogan has continued because, in large measure, it plays very well both at home and in the Arab world and elsewhere. And also, it has suited him phenomenally well in the Turkish electoral system because it has pushed every single other issue off the front pages and the television. So he's coasting to what was going to be a great electoral victory anyway, election victory. So, but the final thing I want to say about Erdogan is that there's Turkish foreign policy and there's Erdogan. And the two don't always go hand in hand. And we have seen that Erdogan, ever since the 2007 elections, has been increasingly irascible and confrontational, not just with foreigners, but domestically as well. And here, there's one huge question mark that lies ahead. And that is something that has nothing to do with Syria, nothing to do with Israel, well, maybe marginally, and that is the Armenian Genocide Resolution that's going to come up in Congress. That it's not just a resolution, it's also a presidential statement on April 24th. What will President Obama say? We don't know. If you look at the constellation of forces, so to say, the President, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, the Speaker of the House, her deputy, are all in favor of passing a resolution. At least that was their position. The dangerous thing here is that many people in the Turkish government and people who have come here from Turkey have basically also threatened by saying, if that resolution is passed, that means the Jewish lobby hasn't helped us. Therefore, we were going to punish the Israelis. There is nothing, you know, so if you think about, and this is going to happen in the next few, you know, April 24th is not that far away.
If you thought these issues were simple, think again. So.
Right, so this interplay is also going to work in, and I have no idea how it's going to play itself in.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, you've been very patient. We have a few minutes left, some final questions.
I'm Kathy Goldberg. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. Pulling it back to a regional level, I haven't heard Iran mentioned in this anywhere, which I find fascinating, actually. And also, to pull it back up, what signals is the U.S. sending with their choices of envoys, of the recent appointment of Chris Hill, some other people, that all of these interrelate? So how is the U.S. sending its own signals here?
Please.
Yeah, from this, Jerusalem Report, I also have a question about Iran-Iranian-Syrian relations. First of all, is it correct that there is a kind of rivalry between Iran and Syria in Lebanon over influence over Hezbollah? If yes, how relevant would that be to Israeli-Syrian negotiations? And the second part is, could Syria play a role as a kind of mediator between the United States and Iran?
Provocative question. I'm going to let someone slip in a final question. Andrew Tabler.
Hi. Just a quick question. After listening to all this and trying to distill it all down, and it's along the lines of the relationship with Iran and the sort of talk of strategic realignment which is going on currently in Washington. And I have a very simple question for Yoram and Tom. Yoram, do you imagine a scenario where Syria, where the Israeli public would accept anything short of a clear division between the Syrian regime and Hezbollah in order to give up the Golan? Meaning that I think to give up the Golan it requires a two-thirds vote in the Knesset or a referendum. So do you imagine a scenario where there could be any kind of wiggle room on this? Would it have to be something very, you know, public, like you were talking about the Sadat's gestures, for example, in 1977? Tom, when you were in Damascus, and I have my own opinions about this, of course, but did you find anyone who told you that President Assad would be willing to make such a public gesture? And the reason why I ask this is, you know, the people that you're working with in Damascus are handpicked by President Assad himself. So I'd be really interested to hear both of your opinions on this very important issue.
Thank you. Unlike in Davos, we're not late for dinner, but we are out of time. If everybody can hang for just a few minutes, I'll allow the speakers, if they don't mind, to give some quick reactions. And in fact, you're allowed to speak in incomplete sentences if you'd like, short phrases, as you wish. So Yoram, you want to start?
I'll be very short. The of course, the Iranian question is the question that is on the mind of everybody in Israel. It wasn't the major topic in the elections because there's no disagreement about that. Everybody thinks the same, almost. Concerning Lebanon, it's quite interesting. There was a conference some time ago in Europe, and there was quite a substantial group of Israeli scholars, people who came from the administration or military circles and are now more independent. And those who spoke about their readiness to see an agreement between Israel and Syria wouldn't mind stronger position of Syria in Lebanon. So much so that the Americans were very unhappy about it. Hey, you are talking about democracy and now you are willing to give the Syrians position in Syria? Their answer was, we trust them that they will be able to control Hezbollah better than anybody else. So to show you how interesting is the whole setup in the Middle East.
We any word on Iran, Yoram or Tom?
No, but the Andrew's question about gestures.
Please.
I haven't heard once in my four trips to Syria in the last 11 months one comment, one initiated comment on what the Syrians could do to lighten, to open up the atmosphere. I just gestures are part of Arab culture, after all. They're fantastic when it comes to these symbols and these the flow of things. But when you're always trying to show your strength, gestures get in the way of that particular value. And it's the same with us sometimes too. So we never want to show that we're quote unquote weak, and gestures are seen as a sign of weakness, or you just don't want to go there. I think when the time is right, whatever that means, there will be a gesture or two that the president of Syria will be able to make.
The speakers don't know yet, but I've volunteered them to stay for a few minutes to address some of the questions maybe that didn't get asked. But please, at this point, just join me in thanking them, and I thank all of you. Thanks for the invite.